Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 7th of April, 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service at theconstructionindex.co.uk. How was your Easter break, Phil?
It was beautifully lazy. I decided it was too cold to even do any work in the garden, so I just kept my head down.
Ah, I'm surprised. I actually got sunburnt on Saturday, and then I got frostbite on Monday. So a bit of a change there. So we're going to introduce our guest. This week's guest is Rudy Klein, a name that will be familiar to many listeners, I'm sure. Professor Rudy Klein, barrister and director of consultancy Klein Legal. Rudy, of course, was chief executive of the Specialist Engineering Contractors Group, the SEC, for over 30 years. And for those who don't know, SEC had a membership of about 7 or 8 trade associations representing several thousand specialist contractors in sectors such as building services, steelwork, electrical engineering, that kind of thing. The purpose of SEC was to fight on behalf of the members for fair payment arrangements and against things like retention abuses and other unfair working practices. Well, Rudy left SEC at the beginning of this year and now works solely through his own legal consultancy. Meanwhile, SEC sort of ceased to exist in its existing format and morphed into something called Actuate UK, which has a slightly wider remit. So, Rudy, welcome to Reconstruction. It's great to have you on. I just wondered, were you scheduled to retire, or did you think that this was a good time to go your own way when SEC ceased to exist?
Well, it's a very good question, Dave. I'm glad you opened with that. I kind of never ever planned to retire, actually. I thought, like a lot of people today, that you can go on forever and ever, and until then something happens, like you die or you face serious illness, And I think the work I was doing and continue to do, I just found it enjoyable. I mean, to me, it was something that just kept me going. When you're trying to change things, when you're trying to make things happen, make a difference, and when you do achieve things, of course, I mean, that's the thing that's the kind of satisfaction that you get, and that really does make life a lot more interesting.
And you have got several quite notable achievements to your name, haven't you? I mean, you are, I think, quite deeply involved in the drafting of the Construction Act, which is, I can't remember what the correct term for the Construction Act, 1996 Construction Act, which really did introduce a lot of changes to contractual arrangements, and it put an end to various abuses such as pay when paid and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Introduced adjudication, mandatory adjudication as well. And you've notched up quite a few successes in your fight against payment abuses, haven't you, over the years?
Well, that's one area that I've been focused on to a tremendous extent, because we all know about the extent and the degree of payment abuse in the industry, particularly as it's directed towards smaller businesses, those who can't fight back. But it goes back, I suppose, to about 1991, that I can remember, when we pushed for an inquiry into construction. And then we had the Latham inquiry, a joint government industry inquiry. That followed after that, the Construction Act, David, as you've just mentioned, which really is quite a revolutionary piece of legislation. And it's interesting that whilst we talk about it as being significant an achievement, obviously, it wasn't something I did on my own. It was work with lots of other people, obviously. Nonetheless, I was probably very much a driving force. And so it's It did make a massive difference. There's no question about it. People often say now, well, what difference did it make? Well, you know, people don't think back far enough sometimes. And in those days, if you had a payment dispute, for example, then you'd have to go to arbitration. That could take years. Now, although we criticize adjudication because it has become rather more costly, still people are using it, particularly for more significant high-value disputes.
Yeah.
And of course, we had amendments to the Act back in 2011. So the Act has improved. I think there are more improvements can be made to it. And the other thing, because I actually drafted the Irish Construction Contracts Act of 2013, which is not quite based on our own. But of course, that legislation was followed in New Zealand, in Australia, Malaysia, Singapore, Isle of Man even. So it's had a tremendous amount of coverage across the world. So it was revolutionary. There's no question. I would add, David, is the project bank account.
Yes.
As well. I mean, that's been quite big. At the moment, I have been writing some guidance for Wales to be used by Welsh government or Welsh public sector clients on putting PBAs in place. But again, that's been a significant development because, of course, it protects the money, keeps the money safe. But there's so much more to do. You know, these things have made a difference. The abuse still continues.
Rudy, project bank accounts you mentioned, they seem to have been emerging for a few years now without having quite come into full flourish. What's the obstacle there?
We have to look at England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and Europe, because they all have their different approaches. England started off particularly well because project bank accounts were mandated, government policy were mandated, unless there were compelling reasons not to use them. And they, I think we have to go back to about 2010 when they all kicked off in England. Now, we had a cabinet office minister then in power called Francis Maude, who was very, very keen on them, pushed them. We had targets for number of projects and value of projects using them. But after a while, they ceased policing implementation of project bank accounts. In other words, the project bank accounts, say, had to be used if there were compelling reasons not to use them, but they were not policing the compelling reasons. So nobody's reporting on compelling reasons. And they kind of lost interest in trying to drive public sector bodies to use them. I mean, Highways England have been the most prolific users of project bank accounts. Hope by 2025, almost £20 billion worth of Highways work will have been paid for using project bank accounts. Major, major drivers. Environment Agency has been another one. But it hasn't been replicated across government or across the public sector. So there's been a lack of policing, a lack of drive, I think, a lack of will to implement them. Now, in contrast, there's been far greater will and drive to implement them in Northern Ireland, where they have to be used for public sector projects over £2 million. The same for Scotland. Again, greater drive to use them in Scotland and in Wales. Wales, they've been in force, or the policy has been in force, about 3 years. It's been rather slow initially. The momentum is starting to pick up. We're hoping there's about almost about £1 billion worth of work in Wales and the pipeline that will be using project bank accounts. So that's for Wales, that's quite a significant amount of money. And in Wales, they have a reporting system. If you don't use them, you've got to explain why you're not using them. You've got to have real justified means not to use them. And of course, in Wales, they also have a system where if you're not using them, they could actually withdraw your grants. This is Welsh government, withdraw your grant aid. So there's a good means. There's a good means of actually enforcing it. I think my view, Phil, is we've got to have legislation on this. You know, we've got to have legislation. I mean, I drafted a private members bill for Debbie Abrahams, who's has been campaigning on late payment issues in the House of Commons. And I drafted a bill about a couple of years ago. In fact, it was more than a couple of years, about 3 years after Carillion collapsed. Unfortunately, it didn't get to second reading because, of course, the parliamentary timetable was disrupted by Brexit. But I drafted this, and in a way, it kind of follows the Queensland example. Queensland have passed legislation last year to mandate the use of project bank accounts across all of Queensland construction by July 2022. And that is to say for projects in Queensland which are worth more than £640,000. So they've gone the right way. I really think here we've actually got to do that here. We've got to legislate for them to make them happen. And of course, the other thing is, going back to your question, why? Well, look, let's face it. There are a lot of major contractors who fought hard, really hard against them, tooth and nail to stop them happening. The government, I'm going to blurt this out. This is going to be, for construction industry index, this is going to be, in fact, newsworthy. The thing, because you're my friend, I'll give you some.
Come on then.
But this has not been said anywhere else. I am aware that when there were discussions on the construction playbook that was published this beginning this year, or was it the end of last year? I can't remember that.
End of last year, I believe.
Was it end of last year? Construction playbook, this was a government best practice document, which were all government departments, agents were supposed to use, and there was a piece on project bank accounts in there. Those representing major contractors, such as Mace, Lang O'Rourke, fought hard against the inclusion of project bank accounts in the construction playbook. That's not being reported anywhere else.
Let's name and shame. Have those names again. Who fought against project bank accounts?
Mace and Lang O'Rourke fought hard against them. And there were others, I don't know names of everybody, but the thing is, and there is a kind of like a rearguard action that follows the major contractors' opposition to project bank accounts a few years ago, when they actually used Pinsent Masons years ago to fight the government on using project bank accounts and government projects. And they used Pinsent to develop their case to take on the government. I can say all this now, you see, because I'm free.
Project bank accounts. We haven't actually identified what project bank accounts are, and I think we're all assuming that our readers know what they are. But it's basically like a sort of an escrow system, isn't it? That the money is held in trust, as it were.
Yeah.
And the client or the main contractor can't use that as working capital.
That's right.
During the project. So.
Well, David, I mean, look, you've explained it better than I can.
But it's also, for background, I should say, it was given big impetus by the Carillion collapse, because a lot of people down the supply chain when Carillion went under didn't get the money that was owed to them, whereas had there been public bank accounts, the money would have been secured there for them to get. So that made it a big political issue as well, didn't it?
It did, Philip. And, it's interesting that Carillion, of course, was involved in the highways work, and given that the Highways England or Highways Agency, as it was then, I think, when Quinley was doing this work, of course, they were subjected to project bank accounts. Now, Highways have told me that when Quinley went bust, that people in the supply chain didn't lose any money on Highways work because the monies were ring-fenced, as David Wright says, they're protected by trust. I think David must have remembered all those legal articles I wrote all those years.
I've memorised every single one, Rudy.
but the thing is, you're bang on. With PBAC, of course, the money's in the bank account, only for a very short time. Everything's done electronically. The client pays the monies in, and then the monies are paid out to the suppliers, to the subcontractors, and those who are there to benefit from these. From these payments. I mean, they're suitable for most projects, frankly. The only thing that might make a difference is the project is a bit, short, maybe 2 or 3 months. You want to set up a project bank account for a short duration project. But was it interesting, going back to Carillion, if I may, for a second?
Yes.
There's a little story, a wonderful story about Carillion. I think people should know, listeners should know, because they, Carillion did the... again, I can tell you all these things because these things have never been published, you see. There's a number of firsts on this podcast this morning. Carillion did the Paddington Station project. They were the main contractor for the Paddington Station project. That was the first kind of station project for Crossrail. And the Crossrail had a policy of project bank accounts, and there was supposed to be a project bank account on the Paddington station work. Now, Carillion actually set up a project bank account, but it was Carillion's account. So instead of setting up an account called Carillion, they just called it project bank account. And I remember I had a steelwork contractor ring me up one morning and say, by the way, we're owed $1 million by Carillion, but we haven't been paid. I said, no, you've got a project bank account. You've got to, don't give me that. You've got to, you will have been paid through the project bank account. And you say, well, they've got a project bank account. And anyway, I got in touch with Crossrail, and Crossrail sent their people down to the Paddington site. They kind of discovered that actually the project bank account was not a standalone, separate, segregated account. It was actually a Carillion account. They were masquerading this time as, instead of Carillion, they called themselves Project Bank Account.
Ah, so that was a little loophole.
But was it a one-off, or do you think it's going on at the moment still?
I suspect, Phil, that it probably is. I mean, there are all sorts of also things are going on. I mean, you know, like in Northern Ireland, for example, they were some contractors have been paying their subcontractors, you know, say, look, we don't support Project Bank Account. So, oh, you don't support them? Good. Right. Here's £1,000 to make sure that you keep repeating that you don't mind project bank accounts. Bam Nuttall apparently just done a study, recently did a study on project bank accounts where they claim that, you know, their supply chain doesn't support them. Now, when we've investigated these kind of things and asked the subcontractors involved, Did you actually say that you don't support them, given the fact that your money's going to be protected and you're going to be paid within about 12-20 days? And you don't support them? Well, we didn't realise that. Well, I know you didn't. Of course you didn't, because you weren't.
So there's a lack of knowledge, really.
Ask the wrong question.
It's partly, David, it's partly a lack of knowledge and partly fear. You know, you don't want to say anything that contradicts, you know, what's been told to you by your contractor. So there's a lot of nonsense going on here. I think either you, David, or Phil mentioned the word obfuscation. I think that's a good word. I love that word because that's what's been going on. But you see, the trouble is these major firms. I don't think they kind of like bought into this business of payment. I mean, we've got all this payment reporting, haven't we? Everybody, you know, we've got Build UK saying, yeah, it's wonderful. We're all reporting on payment now and all the rest of it. Well, the trouble is that whilst it's a good development that we got some idea how long these people have taken to pay you, I'm not decrying that. It's good. It's a good start. But, you know, I can still pay you on time. I can still pay within 30 days, but only paying you a penny. Because I'm saying that all the thousands of pounds that you've applied for, you don't deserve it because when I looked at your work, it's crap. So a penny. But I paid you on time. But I'm paying the right amount. But that's because...
Yeah. Well, this is, I suppose, the problem, isn't it? Because, I mean, the advantage has always been on the side of the employer, the larger contractor, and the further down the supply chain you are, the more disadvantaged you are potentially. And so I assume that it's just a really, really slow process to change the way the industry operates. You can't do it overnight. While you've got entrenched positions like major contractors who are clearly recognise that they have a huge advantage in being able to wield this power and hang on to the money until such time as they feel they can afford to pay, they're not going to relinquish that very readily, are they? And so, although they know that morally and in terms of productivity and efficiency, it's a good thing, they're going to admit that. But they're going to, behind the scenes, try and keep things the way they are because it suits them.
David, I think you're absolutely bang on. I mean, it took me a while to realise all that, you know. But now we're veterans. we're veteran commentators, and I think we this kind of dawned on us over the years, hasn't it? And these things are so embedded, aren't they? So brain. Yeah. And in the culture, there's not a word I really like using, but it is embedded. But the interesting thing is, always remember, sorry going back to Coelia, but, you know, but they were probably reflecting the view of a lot of companies of their size, that they were complaining that their margins are so tight, and that's the only way they can make any money. But, you know, it's a great business. It's a great business model when you think about it. You know, you say, my margins are 1%. That's all I get, 1%, or I get 0.5%. But on the other hand, David, if my business model was that, you know, I was using your money and making 1%, not on my money. So my return of 1% was on your money. That's great. I've got nothing. I'm not doing anything. What a fantastic business. I don't care if it's 0.5%. It's still something, but sure. Because,
of course,
you know, it's a wonderful business model. That's why we're not seeing the back of it, because in fact, because with a business model so wonderful, why would you get rid of it? You're absolutely right. But the Treasury, you know, the government keeps saying, I mean, they said it, the construction sector deal, for example, 3 years ago now. Oh, the business model is broken. The business model is useless. Construction business model, we've got to get rid of it. We've got to sort it. But nobody really wants to. You know, there's all talk about this digital payments. Oh, yeah, we've got to have digital payments. That'll change things. Well, it might make the process more efficient, but doesn't change the fundamentals of the fact that, you know, there are people that use other people's money, given the fact that, you know, 85, 90% of work now is of course, outsourced.
Yeah.
As we know, most of Quillian's work was outsourced. You know, it is an uphill struggle. I mean, it's making these sorts of changes that we're talking about, the construction, project banking, it's an uphill struggle. I mean, but there's nobody out there who says, oh, we oppose project banking. I say, okay, right, you tell me what's going to be better than project banking. What's going to make sure that people get paid within 15, 20 days? Because highways pay everybody within 18 days, down to tier 3 of contracting, which is a PBA. So you tell me, give me something better than project banking, then I'm all with you. You know, we'll have a cuddle. Great, fantastic.
We're talking about project bank accounts in a very black and white way, that they are a good thing, and I can see why they are a good thing. But they did make it into the playbook. I've got the construction playbook in front of me, and it says, as per Cabinet Office payment policy, PBAs, project bank accounts, should be used unless there are compelling reasons not to. But it adds the rider, they are not always suitable. Where might a project bank account not be suitable?
It wouldn't be suitable, Phil, where, as I said earlier, where you've got, like, say, a project of short duration. So, for example, you know, if you've got a project that's going to last 3 or 4 months, well, 3 months, let's say, you wouldn't want to go to the extent necessarily of setting up a project bank account just for that length of project. It may also be, for example, if you've got just a couple of contractors involved in the project, you wouldn't want to set up a project bank account for that. Now, but having said that, I have to say, years ago, I came across one example that was actually explained to me by an architect, where they had a painting contract. And the main contractor did nothing. So the painting subcontractor did everything. But the painting subcontractor was still waiting to get paid after 6 months. So you just had two contractors involved, one main contractor, one subcontractor. So, you know, a project bank account would have actually worked there. So, you know, yeah, there are some very limited areas where they wouldn't work, but particularly, say, where the project is short duration. But the Cabinet Office, you see, when that playbook was produced, instead of just leaving it there, they should have actually either made reference to the occasion where they didn't think the PBAs would work, or they would simply refer to the guidance that they produced, now well outdated, but they produced in 2012 on project bank accounts, where they indicated where PBAs may not be suitable, such as short duration projects. So, but they never did.
It is a very passing reference. It's on page 65 out of 83 pages, and it mentions it just the once. As the it's number 3 in a list of 3 options to mitigate the risk of potential supplier insolvency. So it couldn't be more of a passing reference. So I think Mason Lang O'Rourke did their work, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. I think you're right. When you look, if you go back in those pages, I can't remember exactly which page it's on, Phil, but there's a lot on digital payments. there is a massive amount. Now, that's for everybody, that's fine, because that doesn't really disrupt the system. Now, you say, oh, digital, of course it disrupts the system. I mean, the digital payment process, yes, it makes the process more efficient.
Yes, it's a mechanism, that's all.
Yeah, but it doesn't fundamentally alter the whole payment structure. I mean, the PBA, what the PBA gets rid of is this inefficient process of where you're making payments down the supply chain. So you've got tier one, tier two, tier three, and on it goes. Whereas with the PBA, you just put the money directly into a project bank account and everyone gets paid simultaneously out of that project bank account. It's a much more efficient process. But this nonsense of money is cascading through the different layers. I mean, what happens is, I mean, you know, years ago, Tesco said, we pay our main contractors in 30 days. And then they discovered their main contractor was taking 60 days to pay their subcontractor. And then perhaps the subcontractors were taking 90 days to pay their subcontractors. So everybody gets paid, but then the few days are added on. And Tesco said, what's the point of all that? You know, our money's being used. As it cascades down the supply chain, our money's being used more and more and more. We couldn't have had it for 90 days as Tesco. So they actually made payments directly to their subcontractors in an effort to try and get over that. You know, the one thing that is as good as project bank accounts, or possibly even better, is direct payments. And it's interesting, one of the better things the European Union did in 2014 was to introduce the idea of direct payments. So they said to member states, if you want to use direct payments, please do. The Westminster government decided they wouldn't. The Scottish government decided they wouldn't bother with it, so we never had it. But one thing I would say about digital payments, of course, one thing you can do is facilitate direct payments. Why not?
Yes.
You know, that would be efficient. That would really make a difference. But of course, there'll be a lot of opposition to that as well.
Are they used at all in the UK? Direct payments?
No. I say that, David, I'm not aware of anywhere where they use it. I tell you why there is a reluctance to use it, because I think that there's a fear that if I pay you, you're the main contractor, David, if I pay you directly, let me start again. You're the main contractor, you've got subcontractors. If I pay your subcontractors directly, then you go bust. Then your insolvency practitioner can then come back to me and say, oh, by the way, you've got to pay me again. And so clients fear that they have to pay twice. So I think that is the problem. I mean, but if everybody agrees, I mean, like with project bank accounts, everybody agrees the money's going to be paid in the project bank account. And it's held in trust. The whole point that's it's there in trust is to protect it from insolvency practices. So if you think about the Dracula story, for example, I mean, a trust is a bit like garlic or the cross. You know, the insolvency practice is Dracula. Dracula is approaching, you know, or the insolvency practitioner. By the way, some of my best friends are insolvency practitioners. And they're approached, and you hold up the project bank account, here's the garlic, you know, and or the cross. That's it. You keep them well away. So they work. They're effective. But as I say, the best alternative probably would be direct payments, which you can facilitate digitally, obviously.
Is part of the fragility of the supply chain today tied up in the move away from an intelligent client? I mean, you mentioned Highways Agency and Highways England, rather, and the Environment Agency as examples of good practice. And they seem to have, certainly in the case of Highways England, have brought more expertise back in-house, have become slightly more of a better client with more knowledge there. Whereas there had been a great move amongst an awful lot of public sector clients to outsource everything, to rely on consultants, to basically know nothing but just sort of write the check when told to, where to send the check kind of thing. Has that been damaging to the construction supply chain, that the clients don't really know what they're doing anymore at the very top of the chain?
I think it's more a question of not knowing what they're supposed to be doing rather than that, just not caring. Keep going back to Carillion, but you had government clients using Korean government, who were intelligent clients in the sense they knew about industry, or they've been advised by consultants anyway, and they continue to use Carillion, knowing full well, for example, that Carillion was taking 120 days to pay, unless, of course, they were using the supply chain process to pay early, using 120 days to in which to make payment. So clients knew what was going on. Their consultants knew what was going on with Carillion. They knew also that Carillion, in fact, the balance sheet was just dreadful, but it still gave Carillion work. And as a result, of course, Carillion said, I mean, I saw the letters they were writing to their subcontractors. Oh, by the way, look, you know, HS2 want us to work for them. You know, it's great, isn't it, that, you know, government clients have got faith in us. Why don't you work for us? So I don't left off public sector clients that easily, actually, Phil. I just think it's really a case of, well, why bother? Why should we bother? Or we haven't got the resources, or we haven't got this. Any old excuse, really, not to. If they are serious about getting their projects right by ensuring people are paid, then they would have been more proactive. I mean, Dame Judith Hackett, in a report on building safety that she published in May 2018, she said poor payment practices, including retentions, compromise quality. And, well, yeah, I mean, if I wasn't being paid, or if I wasn't going to get my retention for years, then why bother? Why make the effort? it's clear as night follows day that quality is going to suffer.
Yeah.
But the thing is now, you know, we have this argument about retentions, you know, about protecting retention monies, although some people unrealistically want to get rid of them. We all want to get rid of them, but you're not going to do that overnight. But in the meantime, we should protect them. And everyone's saying, well, okay, oh yes, but you know, we're worried about quality defects, we need retentions, and so on. But there's no evidence that retentions actually improve quality. The evidence is that they actually help to undermine quality. Yeah. So I think that there are big issues around payment. The big issues, those big issues about building safety, about quality, these are the things we need to focus on. And of course, procurement as well. That's, again, I think going back to something that was said early on by David, things are still embedded, you know, changing our procurement process. I mean, we're still doing things traditionally.
Has much changed over the last year, Rudy? I mean, we've had a really strange 12 months, haven't we? And surprisingly, the construction industry seemed to bounce back and get back to work quite quickly. I mean, in terms of the way people are working, has much changed from your viewpoint?
I mean, obviously, the government interventions, with the furlough system, for example, and loans to businesses, I mean, that has helped tremendously, not just construction, obviously other sectors as well. So the thing is that, and of course, construction has continued to be working, and the government has encouraged construction to continue working. And I have to say, and, you know, I don't want to be unnecessarily controversial on this one, but I think one of the reasons is that one of the things that were back in the government's mind was that they didn't want another Carillion. Given, you know, the situation with a lot of the major companies with their finances and their balance sheets, that was a worry.
12 months ago, it seemed inevitable that we were going to have another Carillion. It seemed unavoidable.
It was. The speculation was who,
yeah.
You know, and when, but who. And I think, you know, that was one of the factors that caused the government to say, well, okay, you know, we want construction to continue working. But the thing is, in terms of, though, you know, David's question of the past year, what have we actually made? Has there been a massive difference? Not really. I suppose the industry on the ground, I'm not talking about, you know, the top end, but on the ground, the industry has continued to work. There's been some flash points, particularly where certainly a lot of subcontractors have felt under pressure to work and put their workforce, expose their workforce to risk.
Hmm.
There's been quite a bit of that. I know because I've been advising some firms really on their position in this situation where they felt that they needed to carry on working, because if they didn't, then they would face all sorts of claims about delays, in regard to delays and so on, and they would be denied payment. So there was quite a bit of that pressure going on, and let's make no bones about it. Overall, people think we're working together, trying to get things done. Work slowed down, of course, as we know. Clients were not making decisions on or allowing projects to go ahead. But now I think we're in a situation where firms are coming out. As you were saying, David, I think firms are getting busy. The risk really now for many firms is overtax themselves, overtrading. That is going to be a major risk area as we go over the next few months. That firms will find it very, very difficult to resource some of their work. Find that borrowing is very difficult. Bank borrowing and bank lending has not been terribly generous over the past 12 months. And so, you know, there are some of these problems could be stored up. There's a lot of talk about litigation. I know, I mean, friends of mine in the legal industry are talking about litigation. I don't see that at the moment as being a major problem. There will be some, particularly obviously with some of the bigger value type problems. There will be some, no doubt, over the next few months, but I can't see any major outpouring of claims and litigation at this stage. I'm you know, fairly close to a number of companies, and that really, there are no signs of that as yet. You can't rule them out. Never can rule these things out. Some of these things have probably been stored up, no doubt, over the past 12 months.
Yeah.
I mean, the one thing, you know, there's been talk about so much with COVID. Well, you know, things are going to change now. You know, we're post-COVID landscape is going to look different. You know, the Construction Leadership Council has got a program of change, of resetting the agenda for construction. But, you know, I can't really see things changing unless there's something there to make it change. You know, there's got to be a resource. We've never had a resource. We've never had a that enables us to drive change. How do we implement the change? Who's going to implement it? When? How? Nobody really thinks about that. You know, the great thing about construction is that we are brilliant at reports, initiatives, strategies, agendas. I think, you know, over the years we've produced so many of them. And I actually spent a couple of years ago, and this is absolutely true, one summer, I didn't have much to do. I sat out in the garden and I read from cover to cover about 15 reports that had been produced 2 years previously, starting with the farmer report. That came out in October 2016. And exit report, and then I've read others, like a lot of the reports that came out of the House of Commons Select Committees on Carillion, Dame Judith Hackett's report, construction sector deal. I read these reports, and I distilled the recommendations, and they came down to about a dozen. For example, you know, lowest price, poor procurement decisions, risk transfer, supply chain bullying. All these themes, we're all in all these reports. And you've spent millions producing them reports to come to the same kind of conclusion.
None of them are new, are they, those conclusions?
No, exactly.
Nothing new. I mean, we've heard all this before. But where they've all gone? They've kind of like, there must be somewhere that tends to gobble up these things before to happen.
Well, I think it's rather like, as I said earlier, you tend to find it's the tier one contractors who are most vocal in their support of initiatives such as this. You know, they're right behind Latham, Egham, Pharma. They want to modernise because they don't want to die, to paraphrase the Pharma report's title. But as you mentioned earlier, they talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk, to coin a phrase, that the same old entrenched principles still apply. So they say one thing and they do another.
But it's very hard for one person in unison to change. It has to be the whole industry together. I don't think yes. One tier one contractor could march off, you know, march to the beat of its own drum. It would not get work, I guess.
Yeah, I'm inclined to agree with that, Phil. I think that's absolutely right. You know, I mean, if I was a director of a tier one contractor, I think I'd be in the same position in a way, that I might be able to make some change here and there. Nothing terribly earth-shattering, but nonetheless, I really wouldn't be able to drive anything. The trouble is, what I've always resisted is those who say, oh, well, you know, as you've seen in many reports, oh, construction's got to change, you know, the industry's got to sort itself out. And the industry's not going to sort it ever. I mean, it's too fragmented. There's too. It's a small business type industry.
Yeah.
The overwhelming majority of firms that deliver the product are small firms. You know, are employing under 10 people. Are they going to change now? So it's got to be done externally. What interesting in Singapore, and I know Singapore is a much smaller industry, but Singapore have a statutory body called the Building and Construction Authority. It's a statutory body set up about 2012, and that has a massive agenda of change, focusing a lot on SMEs, and they have brought about change, and they have made improvement. But they have been properly resourced to do that. These are things that we need. I mean, you know, I think we need a public procurement regulator.
That can be your next project, really.
That's my next project, yeah. I'm trying to actually argue for it in Wales, you know, that we should have one. I'm trying to persuade Welsh government to do one. But the regulator, we have regulators for other industries, don't we? But the regulator's role should be to improve, challenge bad practice, adjudicate on complaints of bad practice. You know, there is a properly resourced regulatory authority for the industry. I think it's what's needed. You take supermarkets. Christine Tackle she's the groceries code adjudicator. She administers an ethical code of practice for the treatment of suppliers, with the suppliers, that is, say, to the 10 largest supermarkets. Now she has a penalty. She can impose a penalty of up to 1% of turnover. So if, in fact, for example, Tesco's are taking suppliers' products off their shelves without telling the supplier or saying to the supplier, if you want your products back, you've got to pay us a sum of money, then she will investigate. And then, of course, if Tesco have found to have committed wrongdoing, they can be fined up to 1% of turnover, which I think in Tesco's case would be probably about £7 million. So
yeah.
Nothing to sniff at. So the supermarket is actually quite worried, because it's not just the penalty, it's the publicity.
Yes.
So I just think it's interesting, the Queensland legislation I was telling you about earlier, about the PBAs, at each bit of this legislation, they have points. So if you don't comply with this bit of legislation, that's 400 points. Then you get the next bit. If you don't comply with this bit, that's 500 points. And if you amass, 10,000 points, you can go to prison.
Wow.
Great system, you know.
Yeah.
So I just think that, you know, we need to consider something a bit more drastic.
There was a campaign in the 1970s for building industry nationalisation, which made quite a lot of noise at the time. We don't talk much about nationalisation these days, but we've got used in the past years to doing what big state tells us to do, and we're all under control of government edict. Is now the time to start talking about building industry nationalisation again?
Well, I must admit, Phil, that's never, ever something I've never... I mean, I don't know what you're saying, but it's never entered my mind at all.
I just put it out there.
Why not? It's an interesting question. My thought would be to say, well, okay, let's try and... going back to some of the nationalised industries, the old ones like gas, for example, utilities, for example, they're regulators, don't they? So they've gone from being nationalised, gone into the private sector, but then they're heavily regulated. They're kind of like, they were a bit reluctant to kind of like take the yoke of nationalisation completely off them. So they're kind of like in this midway point, aren't they?
Well, what's quite interesting is Highways England was given a regulator. The Office of Rail became Office of Rail and Road when Highways Agency became Highways England, but it doesn't regulate everything. It only regulates certain things. doesn't it? I don't think it has any regulation over road safety, for example, but that's changing, I believe. And so there's only sort of quasi-regulation for Highways Agency, Highways England, rather. But I wonder whether that couldn't be given a regulator, have procurement coming into its remit, into the regulator's remit there.
Well, I actually happened to study a lot of these regulated regimes about 2 or 3 years ago, because I developed a paper to be sent to the Scottish Government on a regulator. So what I did a trawl through the different regulatory systems, and they are different. You know, looking at the regulatory system, for example, for financial misconduct, looking at the regulation system for the utilities, for example, including rail. And they are a bit different, obviously, in terms of what they're trying to achieve. But if you distill what a lot of them are trying to achieve, they are trying to address bad practice. So, and they are trying to improve overall the particular sectors, the efficiency of the sector, the way the sector does business, business ethics. There's so a lot of the elements of these regulators are about that. I mean, I would be quite keen, for example, to have a code of ethics for construction, starting off with the public sector, and that you'd have a statutory regulator that would then regulate then compliance with a code of ethics, a bit like the grocery code of Unigate I referred to earlier. Mm-hmm. So I would be certainly keen to bring back a regulatory, or to have a regulatory system, I should say, for construction, but not just about bad practices, but also on the positive side, about driving improvement, improvement in efficiencies, improvement in procurement. I mean, we're all taxpayers, but we are paying hand over fist for infrastructure, public sector projects at the moment, which where I believe we, for every pound we spend, we're wasting a pound. I mean, if you look at the report, I think it was the Infrastructure Project Authority produced for, I think, the last month for 2019 for infrastructure. And I think only about 3 out of 125 projects came out meeting expectation. Was the expectation in terms of cost, value, and so on.
Hang on, I think we need to repeat that. It's worth that bears repetition, really. You're saying that for every pound the taxpayer spends, a pound is wasted.
A pound is wasted. I mean, most of the waste that is wasted, and that's probably conservative, most of the waste is the result of the divide between design and construction. So what happens is that when it comes to construction, then you're trying to make designs work. We waste billions each year in trying to make designs work when it comes to implementation. And the reason for that is because, in fact, those responsible for construction, delivery of construction, well, not just construction, but obviously masons and FM, are having to grapple with the problems with design because they haven't actually been involved in developing design in order to make sure that design is fit for purpose. The government published, or launched, I should say, last year, two frameworks, one £30 billion framework just on construction, and the other framework was on design or design and professional services. But why two separate frameworks? Why not bring these things together? And and the sooner we start to have systems such as, or procurement systems such as alliancing, where you've got the team working together on the design solutions. I mean, one of the things we've got at the moment, which I've been heavily involved in the last few years, which I think is really excellent, is something called insurance-backed alliancing. The first project was done on Dudley College, an extension of Dudley College, finished about 2017. And the whole point about insurance-backed alliancing is that you've got the team working with a client to develop design solutions. Those design solutions are best for project solutions, which are then incorporated into a cost plan or affecting the cost plan. And then the other thing is that the team has to then consider risk robustly, because the insurers will insure the cost plan, and they will have technical financial assessors appointed to make sure that the risk management processes have been conducted by the team in robust fashion. And the first project that was piloted this was, as I say, at Dudley College, We saved, I think, achieved about 6.5% savings. Not a lot, but we'd like to think that that would work up to 50% in time, 20% of savings. And those savings were the result of people coming together, agreeing solutions together, incorporating the solution and cost plan. No cost plan these days is reliable because, in fact, they don't reflect proper risk management. We don't manage risk. This is the problem.
Was there any compromise on quality on that project? Often when we talk about cost savings, it's because we make things out of cardboard instead of wood.
Yeah, it's not price, it's cost. We're talking about, really. Price, you know, as Oscar Wilde says, you know, we know the price of everything, but the value of nothing.
Yeah.
There's cost, there's price, there's value. And so I'm really looking at what things are costing. And the important thing about, let's say, the Dudley project and the insurance back to line, you're pointing people on their ability to deliver quality. So when you're pointing people, you're asking the question is, what are the skills of your people? What experience have they had? Having work done at home, I've got work done actually in the background at the moment at home, you know, and I'm thinking, I'm asking myself, when I speak to people, you know, people coming to do work, I say, well, what experience, what skills, where the skills are. To me, that's more important than anything else. I prefer to pay a price if I'm getting those skills on my job. Top level skills that can deliver the quality. And to me, this is the future. We've got the third project now, Derby Silk Mill, almost complete. On the Dudley project, for example, there was a performance energy rating of A for that project, performance certificate A. There's also, I think it finished 4 weeks ahead of time because it had to be open by the autumn term. It was 4 weeks ahead of time. And so it was actually in all respects, it improved upon traditional procurement. It's all logged in by Reading University. It's all captured, the experience was captured at Reading University. But what we need now, trying to get the government and encouraging government departments to use this, it's been an uphill struggle. A massive. I mean, you know, when the EU regulations were around, they still are around, but, you know, they're looking at the EU, we wouldn't be allowed to do that under the EU regulations. Well, it's just absolutely nonsense. But we couldn't get government, even though government approves this as a procurement approach. Cabinet Office approved it. Cabinet Office has got guidance on it. Getting a government department or a public body to use this route. And when you think about it, I as a taxpayer, if the insurance company is saying, we will insure the cost plan. So if there's an overrun, then subject to an excess, we will then allow the policy then to kick in to cover any excess. As a taxpayer, great. And so once the insurance policy is incepted and says, yes, this project can go ahead, that gives me some comfort then that cost plan is reliable, there's proper risk management processes have been in place. I mean, as I said earlier, we don't manage risk. We just pass it down, don't we?
Is the model you're talking about the same as used in the water industry alliances? Because alliances are quite well-intended. I know Anglian Water have done a lot on this, particularly. Is it the same sort of approach? It sounds it.
It is very similar. I think the biggest difference here is that you've got an insurance company involved, heavily involved, because obviously they don't want to take on more risk than necessary. And so they have assessors, external independent assessors, to assess your risk management process at the outset, from the beginning, make sure the desired, of course, is properly risk managed, that it is capable of delivery. So that's why the whole team is appointed at the outset to do that. And then I say the insurance policy, it's a financial loss policy. It's not a liability, but you don't have to prove liability. There's no blame. There's not a blame culture here. And so then that the difference would be, I say, you've got insurance. I mean, this has got to be the way ahead. And if I was the client, I'd certainly want this all the time, I would have thought.
Well, Rudy, it's been absolutely wonderful having you on, and I've learnt an awful lot. I thought I knew about what you did for a living, but actually you do a lot more than I had realised. So it's been great. We're going to have you back sometime to talk about some more of these issues and others, no doubt. But for now, thanks ever so much. It's been a pleasure, and we'll speak to you again soon.
Lovely to see you both.
Rudy, thank you very much indeed.
And you, Rudy.
And you look after yourselves.
And you. Cheers.
Cheerio. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Well, wasn't that fabulous? And trouble is, we've now run out of time for all the other things that I did plan to talk about. I wanted to have a moan about the preponderance of overseas companies, foreign-owned contractors, on the shortlist for the biggest ever road tunnel that's going to be built in the UK, the Lower Thames Crossing tunnels.
Oh, yes, the Lower Thames. Yep.
Dutch, Spanish, and French. Murphy are in there, but essentially it's the Dutch-owned Bam Nuttall, Spanish-owned Ferrovial, Spanish-owned, who have we got? Dragados and Hochtief, who sound German, but actually Spanish-owned now. We've got Bouygues, the French company. We've got Vinci, the French company. So there's not a lot of British stuff going on there. And it shouldn't really matter. Taxpayers' money. I'd rather get something done for the best price, all things being equal, as long as it's being done well. But it does seem a shame, and we're supposed to be post-Brexit building back better, that we haven't got the indigenous expertise or appetite for risk, perhaps, to take it on.
Well, that's taking back control for you, Phil.
We also haven't had time to talk about the new big Liebherr crawler crane that's arrived in the country. Lange Rourke's plant operation, Select, have taken delivery of their battery-operated crane, which is very interesting. But particularly interesting that I said to them, what's the first job for it? And they said, we're not allowed to tell you. We'll let you know as soon as we can, which obviously means it's HS2. It's a bit like, I remember listening to a famous movie star being interviewed by Simon Mayo on the radio about whether who's going to be in the next, I think it's either Star Wars or Batman film or one of these big blockbuster movies. I hear you're in the new Star Wars film or whatever it was. And the film star said, oh, I'm sorry, I'm not allowed to talk about that. I've signed a non-disclosure agreement. Okay, that's that question answered then.
Thereby confirming it.
So I take Select's reply, or Lange Rourke telling me that they're not allowed to tell me where the crane is going, is confirmation that it's going to HS2. And also, no time to talk about the relaxation of planning laws, the extension of permitted development rights, which maybe we'll come back to in another week, because that's quite an important one. But no, I think that's all. That's all. So for another week, thank you very much, everyone, for listening to Reconstruction. Once again, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.